Welcome everyone to the Mental Health Mukbang, where we try to make mental health easily digestible. My name is Jed. I'm a therapist based out in LA. And today I've got nachos.
Nice.
And
one up us, Jed.
I'm not trying to one up anybody. Yes, I just ordered my lunch, okay?
This is a competition. Not Asian. Okay, go ahead.
I'm Jenny Wang. I'm a clinical psychologist from Houston, Texas, and I am having skinny dipped almonds. These are really good. Target or somewhere you can find them.
Super what good. Are they dipped in? Yogurt or chocolate?
They're in chocolate, but they're like a thin layer of chocolate, and it's dark chocolate, so it's not like super sweet. They're really yummy, and they have other flavors.
I love dark chocolate, but I like the name skinny dipped.
I'm Christopher Vo. I'm an MFT based out of Houston, Texas as well. Today, I made myself a homemade KFC bowl. I'm starving. I have shrimp chips, and then I have a kale salad because I'm really healthy.
Cool. Not as healthy as me because I wolfed my lunch down. So I'm Jeannie Chang, LMFT in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I already ate my lunch because I was starving, Marvin. I ate kimbap. But for dessert, I have one apple slice left, but no. Of course, I was at the Korean market and I got Korean. So this is a Korean donut. It's basically like a cinnamon, sugar, cinnamon, actually sugar. So that's later. If I feel like we get intense talking about anxiety, I'll eat this.
Yum.
So what are we doing today, Jeannie?
Yeah, we're going to be answering your questions, y'all. Mm-hmm. Did I just say y'all? Oh my.
Y'all.
I really
turned rubbing off on you now.
Southern. Yeah, we're going to answer your questions and hopefully we get through as many of them as possible.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I posted up in Subtle Asian Mental Health last week and got a lot of questions. So unfortunately, we can't go through all of them, but I feel like a lot of them had some overlap and a lot of the questions we've also answered in previous videos, right? But to start out, Anika Hussein asked how to recognize signs of anxiety and when to seek help. To the floor.
I think seeking help is really dependent on the person. You know, what is disruptive for one person or difficult to manage may be very different for the next person. But I would say that if you already feel a sense of that the anxiety is starting to disrupt your functioning, like making it hard to go to school, go to work, be at home with your kids, things like that, then I would consider seeing somebody. Or if it's really distressing, right? If it's enough where you are not able to sleep at night, having a hard time doing daily things like driving and getting out of the house, then those would all be signs that it's time to seek help.
Yeah. I think to go back on our last video a little bit to how anxiety is naturally occurring in all of us, right? Mm-hmm. And that anxiety exists on a spectrum. To kind of normalize a little bit, I think we can all cope with it or utilize it a little bit better, right? Therapy in general is oftentimes stigmatized because if you go to therapy, you have a problem. But if you had sought therapy along like way before these issues had become a crisis, you know, before they became unmanageable, then it wouldn't have been a problem in the first place. So, you know, I think any of us can use help and utilize some of these tips to handle stress a little bit better.
Answered the first part of that question though.
What's up?
The first part of the question was, how do you know if you have anxiety?
Oh, right.
Right. So
that's a trick. I feel like that's this is how I would answer that, just as to play along with Chris, not play, just to go along with what he said. It's also normal to experience anxiety because that is a normal reaction to any kind of stress. So I think depending on the situation you're going through, don't see it as abnormal, which I think people tend to see a little bit going, oh my gosh, because it's a terrible feeling. It doesn't feel good, right? It's that dread in your stomach. It does a lot to your physical well-being. And I think it's important to not over-dramatize it. That's the lack of a better word, because I want you to also understand that there's a tolerance level that also needs to happen with anxiety. But as Jenny said, when it gets to the point where it does hinder daily functioning, simple tasks that you normally can do, your thinking process, you're just super overwhelmed. You know it when you can't even do the simple things, then yes, that's probably when that anxiety has reached that level of you may need more assistance. But generally speaking, feeling anxiety is normal throughout the day, depending on what you're experiencing. Yeah. So I just say to folks, sometimes sit with it a little bit and know if it does get out of control, then and that you can't manage it over time. I would say give yourself some time, right? Because on a given day, it might the next day you're like, oh, you know what? That's what it was about. It was because I was stressed out about a phone call that I got, and today I'm good. So right. I say kind of give that tolerance level.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And anxiety exhibits itself in different ways, right? A lot of times people focus on, you know, the extreme symptoms of it, when it, like panic attack, feeling like the world's closing in around you, loss of sense of time, those types of things, right? But anxiety can also be avoidance, right? We talked about imposter syndrome, analysis paralysis, the toolbox fallacy, those different types of things. What are some other ways that anxiety can exhibit itself, whether they be somatic or mental, that people might overlook?
I think one of the things that, well, I was just about to bring up avoidance until you said it. I was just like, darn, you took my answer. But one of the things about anxiety, right, is that sometimes it's you start to recognize it when you have this kind of general preoccupation with something. Like, if you find yourself thinking about something, like, over and over again, and it kind of preoccupies a lot of your thoughts, that's usually a sign that points towards the fact that it might be stressing you out, and it might be trying to pull your attention, and that it's causing you some kind of distress, because your brain is constantly coming back to it. So it's kind of like, I think one example to borrow from school, right, is that you have that impending feeling of like dread that comes with knowing that there's a test or like a paper due. That's that feeling of anxiety, right? You know it's coming, and you constantly, it comes up and you think about it over and over again. That's usually a sign that you're feeling a little bit of anxiety. So that's another way that it could show up. If we're talking about specifically like avoidance, right? If there's something that you find yourself trying to not do a lot of the times, it's probably because it's causing you stress, and the easiest way for you to deal with it is to just avoid it.
No, I'm totally kidding. I was going to say also, two things came to mind. I just forgot the first one, but over-functioning. Just because I tend to do that. I think we talked about this before, maybe overproductiveness. I'm not saying there's really such thing as that, but when you see yourself overdoing I think it's also an avoidant method to not feel. So you do, and that's kind of the side I tend to err on. I'm just gonna do all this stuff, and so just not even thinking about it. Then obviously it just can get more distressful, right? Because you're just not tending to your own emotions and not being grounded. So that would be another sign when you know those people, when you're around them, you're like, oh my gosh, they're just exuding that anxiety. Another thing I like to say that helps people ground is when you're anxious, you know how you keep on thinking and living in the what ifs? What if I die? Or what if I get COVID? What if this happens? And I think that's very common to think that way, but I just tend to say, hey, let's just change that sentence to what is? What is? Like, the what is I'm not sick. The what is my son is okay and he's having fun. I'm talking about college. So that's just, I don't know if I really answered that question, but that is something I say because it takes us to the future. Anxiety likes to look at what we can't control, which is a lot, but we can also control a lot as well, which is now in the present moment. So yeah. What if, switch to what is.
Yeah, I really like that, living in the what ifs. Our next question, Rachana Chan Chu, sorry if I butcher anyone's name. Some nights I can hear my own thoughts when I close my eyes and try to sleep, although I'm physically tired and sleepy. I'd like to know why and how I should deal with that. So it sounds like she's describing intrusive ruminating thoughts when she's really tired or exhausted, right? How do you guys feel about that?
What was the first part of the question?
She says that some nights she can hear her own thoughts when she closes her eyes and she's trying to sleep, but she's just exhausted. So I'm assuming her thoughts are like keeping her up at night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For me, I kind of envision this as like, if you've ever played video games, if you have like a stamina bar, right, it takes a certain amount of energy to do anything, right, throughout the day. And it takes a certain amount of energy to, hold back some of those intrusive thoughts as well. So when you're physically exhausted and you lay down and you're trying to just relax, you don't have the energy to kind of withhold and control some of your thoughts as well. So I would say, honestly, get to sleep earlier, right? Practice some self-care, do some things to shore up some of your mental stamina so they aren't so exhausting to combat.
I like that. More sleep begets more sleep. The other thing I was going to say is, going back to, when you're not facing your emotions throughout the day and you're just trying to be super busy, you're living on that, you're living off that adrenaline. And then when you go to bed, it kind of just crashes, right? And that's when all of a sudden the things that you were probably not thinking about or choosing not to just hit you all at once because that adrenaline crash. So that might be hit hormonally speaking. And I know that happens to me sometimes at 3 a.m. where I'm like, oh my gosh. And then you start thinking and it's hard to stop. So I would be very much aware how you're doing a simple schedule. Like sleep is, I do prioritize sleep. I think it is. And I said, more sleep begets more sleep. So less sleep, I feel like begets less sleep, you know, and that happened with when I had kids. So I feel like it's really important to prioritize it, make sure you're getting the amount of sleep. And if you're super tired, that what happens is you sleep less. That's what I find, you know, over fatigue. That's just my experience. But...
And when finally, I would also say like, create a safe space to handle some of those thoughts, right? Mm. That's your brain trying to process some of the things that you've been trying to avoid, most likely, right? So find a time when you are, again, you know, healthy, you know, have that mental stamina and create that safe space and understand that you don't have to carry those thoughts outside of that safe designated time and space.
I think that when it's the nighttime sleep, I often recommend that you keep a notepad next to your bed. Because a lot of times you're thinking, oh, I need to do this and this and this tomorrow. And then you're worried that you're going to forget it. And so you're trying to like memorize it. And so sometimes just turning on like a little light, like a reading light, and jotting down some of those concerns, almost in a way of like getting it out of the mind into a physical form. And then knowing that you have it down, you can return to it tomorrow. And then I've also... this is something I haven't recommended a ton, but I've heard of it, is where people like schedule time to worry. Like when I wake
describe
up,
worry, yeah.
Right. And they like, you know, find a time, like Chris said, where it is a safe space. You're not distracted. You're able to just kind of like sit in that worry a little bit.
Yeah.
And give it space to breathe. And sometimes then it doesn't have to push through during those kind of uninhibited times of like falling asleep. And so giving it some space intentionally in your day.
Here's a thought as a clinician. The reason why you probably haven't prescribed that much is because they're doing it with you in therapy. Because that's what a lot of clients do, right? They say, I don't have to deal with this now because I'll handle it whenever I see, you know, us in the office. What about you, Jed? Anything else?
Yeah. I kind of want to touch on it could be because of a lot of different reasons. It's really hard to say specifically why you're experiencing that, but generally I'm going to go with kind of what Chris said. If something is popping into your head at night, it probably means that there's something that hasn't been dealt with during the rest of the day. If you're really physically tired and physically exhausted, it sounds like you're doing a lot of stuff, which doesn't give you a lot of time to process. And a lot of times... your brain finally has that time to say, oh, hey, like this happened and this happened. Like we should probably figure out what to do about it. It's probably in that moment that your brain's like, hey, we have time. Can we like deal with this real quick? So I would say something similar to what Jenny said is I actually find that really helpful for myself because I feel like a lot of my thoughts come in at night right before I sleep. And so I actually keep a notepad by my bed so that if there's things that I come up with and I'm like, oh, that's a really good idea, or something happens, then I can like just write it down. And then I find myself falling asleep in the process of writing a lot of the time. And that might be helpful for you just to have something to like direct your attention to instead of letting the thoughts just kind of swim about freely. Because once you kind of put it down, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of like there's a fly in the room, and putting it and writing down whatever's going in. Like, imagine there's a fly in your brain. That's essentially like just taking the fly and then putting it in a jar, or just like capping it. And then just like, I'll deal with it later or something. And that's kind of the process of writing things down for me before I sleep.
No, I like that analogy. Yeah. Mary Catherine Kerr asks, how to overcome anxiety about anxiety? I think that's a big one, right? You end up just getting into this feedback loop of being anxious about being anxious, or being worried that you're going to go into another panic attack.
Yeah. I was also going to suggest one thing, because I think we all can benefit from this. Instead of just immediately just going to bed, but having that routine, like an hour before you will shut down, meaning no phones, maybe enough reading, something to completely relax you. So you know, so your brain is just slowly going there. And even if you're reading, you may think those thoughts, but you know that you'll go to bed in like 30, 40 minutes. So it gives your time to unwind and have those thoughts before bed. Like Jenny was talking about having those worry times. I do find that progressive muscle relaxation, I know we're not, that's like a, I find that works when people, before they go to bed, they can lie down and do it and just listen to that music or whatever. And there's so many good YouTube demonstrations that I've seen that are actually pretty good. That yeah. I've recommended to clients that wanted something for bed to really relax them and not hear a voice, but just some instruction of, okay, now squeeze the muscles in your shoulders, or, you know, and it just helped them focus and ground themselves for like 30 minutes. So that could be something that'll work to help you sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep is so important.
It definitely is. And I don't get enough of it.
No, I'm exhausted too. Admit it. When I don't sleep well, stress level goes higher, you know? So definitely have to prioritize it.
So back to Mary's question, how to overcome anxiety about anxiety, right? The feedback loop of anxiety, or thinking you should talk to someone about your anxiety, but that being too anxious to actually talk to them about it.
Go ahead.
I think it's, you know, breaking it down to its smallest possible piece, right? Whatever your goal is, try to figure out what your anxiety is telling you, right? So if you're being, if you're anxious about a project, if you're anxious about talking to someone else, right, then take that goal and imagine it, right? Really visualize exactly what it is you're trying to do and look at the smallest possible piece. If it's the project, then, you know, go all the way into researching, right? Thinking about researching is even a big one, right? That contemplation and pre-contemplation stage. If it's talking to someone else, I'm assuming you have someone in mind, right? And try to think about all the other occasions where you've talked about difficult topics with them and whether or not they've been welcoming. And even if they haven't been welcoming, when you had to bring up a conversation like that, how you could then word or phrase things better, right, in order to, you know, get your message across.
Done.
Anyone else? No.
I feel like,
to admit, I missed the question.
Overcoming anxiety about anxiety.
Okay. Like, I know it's about anxiety, but I didn't hear what he said.
I think it's also helpful to look at the perspective. I keep saying this, I sound like a broken record, but anxiety is normal. And just thinking, hey, it's normal. Just like Chris said, what am I anxious about? Well, of course I'd be anxious about this, because it's hard having a conflict with somebody. And it's something that I call self-stigma. Sometimes we have our own self-stigma about what we're experiencing. And I think that's super important to look at ourselves first about why we have this, because then that just kind of trickles outside externally. So that, I just like using that word. So it kind of saying, hey, this feeling is normal and I'm feeling this way, so it's uncomfortable. Let me think of what I'm going to do about it. Right.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to take away that feeling completely. And that's what happens. You're like, I don't like this feeling, so let me just do everything I can. And I think that just exacerbates it, because you're almost avoiding. Avoidance is a huge
sure.
part of this, you know?
Yeah. One way that I've talked about anxiety is like misplaced excitement. So utilize that energy. Your anxiety is trying to tell you something like, this project's important. This person is important to me. That's why this conversation is a big deal, or this work really matters. But what happens? You end up getting paralyzed by it. And then you end up having to rush. And then the end product isn't what you wanted it to be, right? And that fuels this negative feedback loop. So, you know, those nights when, you know, I end up waking up and I'm like, oh, I have to work on this, blah, blah, blah. And now I'm caught in a feedback loop of, well, now I can't sleep because of my anxiety. So now my work is going to be, you know, stunted tomorrow. I'll literally just roll out of bed and start doing a little bit of work and go, hey, I'm not going to be able to sleep. So why am I wasting this opportunity and being upset that I can't sleep? Let me work on this for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Sure enough, I get a little bit tired, right? Go back to sleep and, you know, continue that process. So just utilize that energy, utilize the excitement.
I like that. I do that too. That's why I have these talks at 3 a.m. Jed's side, or it's 4 a.m. here. Remember, I've done that a couple times. Instead of focusing on that, I'll just make use of that time, right? Until I get sleepy.
So basically, Jenny's the only one that kind of gets sleep.
Yeah. Basically, Jenny's the only normal person in this call.
Who didn't hear the question? No, I'm kidding.
I think I have something specific about like thinking about, so I think they said they were thinking about talking to somebody about their anxiety, but they're getting anxiety about talking to somebody about their anxiety. I think part of that is just normalizing talking about your feelings, or just talking about stuff in general. That comes from this, I think that's something that I definitely have experienced with a lot of my clients. Like, they can't actually very recently, it took me a few sessions to just get this person to open up about what it is that the problem was. Like, they recognized that there was a problem and they were coming to therapy, but they just wouldn't tell me what the issue was for a good number of sessions. And then when we finally got to the place where, like, oh, like, this is what's going on, I'm like, oh, you know, now we can like start to get somewhere. But I think part of it is just normalizing that talking, like being open, right? And so the more practice you have, generally the less anxious you'll be. So you don't have to start talking about your anxiety, but you can start talking about all the other small little feelings that you have throughout the day with somebody, like whoever it is, just saying, hey, like, I feel this way right now, or hey, I'm struggling with this right now, or hey, like, this was difficult for me. Just being open and practicing speaking about it and practicing expressing yourself really helps to reduce whatever anxiety it is that you're feeling about talking to someone specifically about your anxiety, right? It's kind of like exposure therapy, but for the anxiety of talking to people. It's, or talking about your feelings, or talking about anxiety itself, it sounds really weird in my head. And as I'm saying it, it's kind of like, does this make sense? But at least from a clinician's point of view, it does. Right, it is lowering your response to these specific stressors that you're experiencing, right? And so the more comfortable you get with sharing about yourself, sharing about your feelings, the easier it will become to talk about things like anxiety.
Definitely.
On that, this is something that I think comes up a lot, especially with the like college, young adult, maybe even high school, is how would you tell your parents that you have anxiety then, right? And because this comes up often when these are often Asian American families, parents are not very well versed in mental health, period. So anxiety is just like, get over it, not a big deal. How would y'all suggest a young person communicate their anxiety to their parents in a way that can be received well?
That's a really hard one, especially in Asian families, because that is the typical response of just get over it, right? Or they compare the things that they went through and shut you down.
I feel like there's not one set answer to that because it really depends on the family. But I would generally ask them or ask the person who, first of all, it sounds like they most of the time want to share with their parents or at least release that anxiety to in somewhat. Then I would be specific and say, why don't you pick your battles? So pick one thing that you feel like, don't go and unleash, you know, years of troublesome things with your parents, because that's just going to make more anxiety, but, and you won't get the reaction that you want. But if it's, there's one thing that you could pick at the forefront that really stresses you out, that'll actually just make you feel better, even if you just bring it up. I even said that. I go, their reaction might not be what exactly you expected, but what's going to happen is that you shared it and said it out loud. And, ooh, I said it. Okay, the cat's out of the bag, but at least I said it. Yeah, they got mad. So I say that. So I go, start from the beginning, just start it, just sharing one thing. And usually they're saying whatever that is, that it might be one of them. Usually I hear a lot college majors. They want to switch their majors. They're not happy. So I'm like, all right, then start off with what you want to do and then explain why you want to do it instead of saying you don't want to do pre-med. So yeah. I say start, don't go big. Have those measurable goals of one thing at a time. And I do think even sharing it, like I said, helps.
Yeah.
You may not get the reaction you want, but just releasing that is a big part of the anxiety. Definitely. Holding it in is like, oh, I'm just thinking of my own child. Yeah, you hold things in. It's just so not good for you, right?
I think you craft the message to the receiver. Oftentimes with my clients, I do a lot of perspective taking, empathy switching. When it comes to crafting an argument, right, or a conversation. So what is the assumption that your parents are making when you tell them that you're too stressed to do something or anxious, you know, about something like that? I think the assumption is that you're being purposefully avoidant. So trying to let them know, one, see if there's any, you know, stories that they can, from their lives that you can kind of draw on to make that connection, or help them understand that you want to achieve these things. You want to do these things and you are trying to do these things, but you are still being overwhelmed. It's not because of a lack of desire, right? That's, you know, holding you back from these things. Yeah. Or like you said, that example of the switching a major, right? That's a hard one. But, you know, what is it that they're worried about if you do switch majors, right? They're worried that you won't be successful, that you won't have prestige, that you won't make money, et cetera, et cetera. But try to, you know, explain it to them in terms that they would understand. If I continue this and I'm doing poorly in school, I'm not going to make it in any way. So I'm not going to make money anyway, right? I'm not going to achieve any of those things that you want for me, where I have a better chance and opportunity if I go this route. It may not go perfect, but that is the best way, in my opinion. Always try to think about exactly what their argument is and craft your conversation around that.
Going one step deeper with that, what is their reasoning? Well, I would also say, what are they anxious about that you're experiencing too? So perhaps they're anxious about the fact that they had to suffer. They don't want to see that with you. That also helps you understand going in, yes, I know that they want a better life for me. That's why they're stressed. So what they're getting, what you're getting with a child or a student is usually the parents' anxiety, their own anxiety, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that I like to talk about a lot with my clients is to identify the core values that the person that you're trying to engage with has, right? For us as Asians, a lot of the time our parents the core values that they have, right, are like stability, safety, and those are things that they get quote unquote anxious about, right? Whether or not they express it the same way we do, is those are things that preoccupy their minds. These are things that they're concerned about, and so crafting, like Chris said, crafting an argument around those core values. But you need to really identify what those core values are, because I think a lot of times the breakdown happens in not really understanding, because there's a different set of values between you and them. And really being able to develop that understanding and really taking that perspective and trying to understand what it is that makes them do the things that they do helps you to create a better argument. It's kind of like This is one of those reasons, like, this is one of those things that we learn in school that nobody really thinks about has practical applications until somebody really spells it out for us, right? Back in high school, you had to write, like, persuasive essays. I don't remember if it was, like, 11th grade or 12th grade or whatever, whatever, right? You had to provide a counter argument to your argument, right? It's not just convincing someone of something. You have to be able to take their perspective and argue back and then be able to answer what their questions are. And so this is basically the same thing. When you're having, when you're trying to get an engage with somebody who might not be necessarily see things the same way, or not, here's the thing, sometimes they might even see things the same way as you do, but it expresses itself differently. And if you can just recognize that we're trying to say the same thing, we're just saying it differently, then it really helps to make that conversation a lot easier. So, like, when it comes to presenting something like anxiety to your parents, right? It's something that they can relate to because they experience it as well. You just need to figure out what it is that makes them anxious. And then once you can understand that, you're like, hey, you know, when you feel blah, blah, blah about this, you know, that's how I feel about this, all right? And that sometimes will go over well and sometimes won't go over well. But it is an opportunity for them to relate to you. You take their perspective so that they can take your perspective. And I mean, sometimes it's a difficult conversation to have most of the time, but it is a way to try to approach those bigger subjects, right? Say with switching majors. It's like, if you really wanted to, you could draw an outline and say, this is the average income for people who graduate with this degree. These are the jobs that they have. This is what it looks like. And then do a whole presentation and be like, are you convinced? But you know, It just comes down to whether or not they're receptive to that. And at the end of the day, you know, whether subconsciously or consciously, what it is that kind of makes them tick. And once you can kind of, it's just a matter of taking that and crafting your, I don't want to say argument, but crafting what you want to express in a way that they'll understand it.
Your message.
All right, Sarah Bernardo. I, myself, and some of my peers are driven by our anxiety. Essentially, our productivity and achievements are fueled by anxiety about failing to meet expectations, whether they be societal, parental, etc. How can I develop healthy internal motivators rather than relying on anxiety to push me?
That's a good question.
Anxiety is a healthy internal motivator.
It can be. I was going to say it can be.
Can be.
It can be.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is a good question, because then it's kind of like she's living off that adrenaline and cortisol. So I was going to say, it's a side note of that, and then hopefully I can get this, but in the workplace, when you're trying to achieve or just have your goals, I have found that young professionals don't tend to ask for help. Meanwhile, they're harboring this anxiety that they don't know how to do something. They can't tell their higher managers or colleagues for the fear of not looking good. And by the way, I'm specifically talking about Asian Americans. I'm not saying everybody else isn't like that, but particularly us, we just feel like we just shouldn't ask for help. I can figure it out. I want to make sure I do. And then I can come to them. And meanwhile, the anxiety builds because you really don't know how to do it. And it's okay. You don't know every skill, right? Every hard skill out there. That kind of relates to this, where just give yourself some grace that first of all, it's good that you're driven, but just know that driven by your anxiety, eventually you will burn out. And so that's why we see young people in their 20s in burnout, because they are trying so hard when they have so many years ahead of them. So I would say, pick one thing. I always go to the one thing, those small measurable goals. A small change can lead to something big, a big change. So a small thing that you really want to accomplish, wherever that is, school, work, one thing is really important. That one thing can turn into like this great job opportunity or career switch instead of all things.
Yeah.
So that's,
but I think she's talking a lot about internal versus external, right? So your anxiety will motivate you, but she's talking about the anxiety about failing to meet expectations from, you know, your parents or other people, or keeping up with the Joneses, right? Yeah. Trying to be overly competitive all the time. How do you work with that?
I I'm still working with that. Oh, is Jenny trying to say something?
Jenny is definitely.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah. Now we can.
Oh, sorry. I would say that for me, it comes down to core values. And that's something that I work with my clients on a lot. Because your core values can be structured such that it is externally motivating, right? Like fame, ambition, money, status, reputation. Or it can be structured such that it's internally driven, like integrity, honesty, like in your identity being formed around being somebody who works hard, who shows up, who's consistent, right? And I think that part of our drives is which core values drive us, right? Like what value would make you go above and beyond? Is it because you're trying to impress other people? Or is it because you believe so much in this mission that you're willing to do work for free, right? That you're willing to do more than what's expected of you. And I think that when it becomes an identity of who you are as somebody who shows up in this certain way, then you show up and however other people view that is up to them, right? You don't take ownership or responsibility over other people's perceptions or value judgments.
Right.
I think the problem often in Asian American individuals is that the goal is not set by them. It's the parents that want you to go to the Ivy League school. It's the parents that want you to go to med school. So are we surprised that you don't have the drive for it? Not really, right?
Yeah.
If it's not your goal, if it's not your vision, it's not your dream, then you're going to have to find an external motivator because internally you are not driven for that. Maybe you wanted to be some chef, right, in New York City, and that's what's driving you. That's the internal motivation that I think this person is kind of asking for. Where do I find that drive instead of fitting everybody else's expectations of me?
Right. And I think you can tie in those external motivators to your own internal, right? Where people focus too much on the wealth. Well, what is the wealth supposed to provide you internally? Safety, security, happiness, right? Is it, you know, what exactly is it supposed to be driving you? Why are they placing those external motivators on you? And what does that mean for you? I think that's really important to figure out.
I think we have time for one more. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think we have one more and then we've got to end it. Let me see. From Matt Yanker, are PRN medications, for example, benzodiazepines, really helping my problem? Or is it giving me a quick fix for an anxiety attack, preventing me from learning how to really cope with the underlying problem?
What was the first one? Or what? What was the...
PRN medications.
Oh. Per as needed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
PRN. Okay. Mm-hmm.
You want me to go first?
Yeah, okay. I was going to have a question with that question. But
okay.
Go ahead.
So here's the way that I like to view medication, right? I think that a lot of times in therapy, the purpose of medication is to bring you to a place where you can be stable enough to develop the skills that you need further down the line, right? Because if you're experiencing panic attacks on a daily basis, you're probably more preoccupied trying to figure out how to manage those panic attacks than you are with to getting to the core of whatever it is that's bothering you, right? So the whole idea is that I think with like PRN medication specifically, right, is that you should be having some skills that you can use in conjunction with those medications, because you should be taking the medication and then practicing whatever it is that you have that your therapist is providing you in terms of practical skills to manage so that you can eventually build up to where you can manage without the medication, right? So it is a quick fix, but it's a quick fix with a purpose, right? It's like, this is the example that I use, right? If your tire has a hole in it, right? Until you get the chance to actually replace your tire, you can go to a shop and you can just patch it, right? And that'll give you something to work with until you can actually get the whole thing fixed properly, right? So that's the example that I like to use with a lot of clients who have questions about medication, And at the end of the day, you want that medication to be a support, right? Because every once in a while, you need a little bit of a crutch, and that's okay, right? There's nothing wrong with having a little bit of an extra leg to stand on when things are going south, especially for things like psychosis and depression, right? It's really hard to get to a place where you're stable and really be able to like think about things outside of whatever is causing you to feel as terrible as you do. Or with the psychosis, right? The psychosis is not just going to go away by itself, but you can learn how to manage it by developing skills. But that means that it has to be suppressed in a certain way before you can really have the consciousness to be able to process it. And so they are helping your problem in a sense, but it's helping you to really develop. It's giving you the opportunity to really develop the skills that you need so that you won't necessarily have to be reliant on them.
Sure. I would definitely, and also, you know, make sure to talk to your psychiatrist and a therapist about these different things. Because in some rare cases, you know, it is a hormonal imbalance and that may be something that you need, you know, in the long term. And there's nothing wrong with that. But really identify that and work with a team that would understand these things a lot better than you would, right?
That's a great answer. Yeah, that's
absolutely
perfect.
Yeah, quick disclaimer. Well, I mean, medication is technically outside of our scope of practice. So yes,
it is. But I think you guys answered it really well. I was just going to turn back the question saying, I was wondering if he has an integrated care model. Does he have a psychiatrist and a therapist or primary care?
Yeah,
but absolutely. I think we do have to wrap up. But if there's more questions, we can always answer them next week. Hmm? Ask away. This is fun.
Yeah, we'll probably try to incorporate this regularly in all of our videos, at least answer a couple of questions too.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should keep it up. So we hope we made this digestible for you. And until next time, I guess we'll see you next week.
All right. So we'll see everyone later.
Bye.